Chapter 58. At these warm words, Winterbourne was not less dazed than he was moved in heart. The novelty of the avowal rendered, what it carried with it, inapprehensible by him in its entirety. Only a few short months ago, completely estranged from his family, beholding Grace going to and fro in the distance, clothed with the alienating radiance of obvious superiority, the wife of the then popular and fashionable Fitzpiers, hopelessly outside his social boundary down to so recent a time that flowers then folded were hardly faded, yet he was now asked by that jealously guarding father of hers to take courage, to get himself ready for the day when he should be able to claim her. The old times came back to him in dim procession. How he had been snubbed, how Melberry had despised his Christmas party, how that sweet, coy Grace herself had looked down upon him, and his household arrangements, and poor Creedle's contrivances. Well, he could not believe it. Surely the adamantine barrier of marriage with another could not be pierced like this. It did violence to custom. Yet a new law might do anything. But was it at all within the bounds of probability that a woman who, over and above her own attainments, had been accustomed to those of a cultivated professional man, could ever be the wife of such as he? Since the date of his rejection, he had almost grown to see the reasonableness of that treatment. He had said to himself again and again that her father was right, that the poor seal, Giles Winterbourne, would never have been able to make such a dainty girl happy. Yet, now that as he had stood in a position farther removed from his own than at first, he was asked to prepare to woo her. He was full of doubt. Nevertheless, it was not in him to show backwardness. To act so promptly as Melberry desired him to act seemed, indeed, scarcely wise, because of the uncertainty of events. Giles knew nothing of legal procedure, but he did know that for him to step up to Grace as a lover before the bond which bound her was actually dissolved was simply an extravagant dream of her father's overstrained mind. He pitied Melberry for his almost childish enthusiasm, and saw that the aging man must have suffered acutely, to be weakened to this unreasoning desire. Winterbourne was far too magnanimous to harbor any cynical conjecture that the timber merchant, in his intense affection for Grace, was courting him now, because that young lady, when disunited, would be left in an anomalous position, to escape which a bad husband, and was better than none. He felt quite sure that his old friend was simply on tenterhooks of anxiety to repair the almost irreparable error of dividing two whom nature had striven to join together in earlier days, and that in his ardor to do this, he was oblivious of formalities. The cautious supervision of his past years had overleaped itself at last. Hence, Winterbourne perceived that, in this new beginning, the necessary care not to compromise Grace by too early advances must be exercised by himself. Perhaps Winterbourne was not quite so ardent as heretofore. There is no such thing as a stationary love. Men are either loving more or loving less. But Giles himself recognized no decline in his sense of her dearness. If the flame did indeed burn lower now than when he had fetched her from Sherton at her last return from school, the marvel was small. He had been laboring ever since his rejection and her marriage to reduce his former passion to a docile friendship, out of pure regard to its expediency, and their separation may have helped him to a partial success. A week and more passed, and there was no further news of Melberry. But the effect of the intelligence he had already transmitted upon the elastic-nerved daughter of the woods had been much what the old Surgeon Jones had surmised. It had soothed her perturbed spirit better than all the opiates in the pharmacopoeia. As he had slept unbrokenly a whole night and a day, the new law was to her a mysterious, beneficent, godlike entity, lately descended upon earth, that would make her as she once had been without trouble or annoyance. Her position fretted her, its abstract features rousing an aversion which was even greater than her aversion to the personality of him who had caused it. It was mortifying, productive of slights, undignified. Him she could forget, her circumstances as he had always with her. She saw nothing of Winterbourne during the days of her recovery, and perhaps on that account her fancy wove about him a more romantic tissue than it could have done if he had stood before her with all the specks and flaws inseparable from corporeity. He rose upon her memory as the fruit god and the wood god in alternation, sometimes leafy and smeared with green lichen, as he had seen him among the sappy boughs of the plantations, sometimes cider-stained, and with apple pips in the hair of his arms, as he had met him on his return from cider-making in White Hart Vale, with his vats and presses beside him. In her secret heart she almost approximated to her father's enthusiasm in wishing to show Giles once for all how she still regarded him. The question whether the future would indeed bring them together for life was a standing wonder with her. She knew that it could not with any propriety do so just yet. But reverently believing in her father's sound judgment and knowledge, as good girls are wont to do, she remembered what he had written about her giving a hint to Winterbourne lest there should be risk in delay, and her feelings were not averse to such a step, so far as it could be done without danger at this early stage of the proceedings. From being a frail phantom of her former equable self, she returned in bounds to a condition of passable philosophy. She bloomed again in the face in the course of a few days, and was well enough to go about as usual. One day Mrs. Melberry proposed that for a change she should be driven in the gig to Sherton Market, whither Melberry's man was going on other errands. Grace had no business whatever in Sherton, but it crossed her mind that Winterbourne would probably be there, and this made the thought of such a drive interesting. On the way she saw nothing of him, but when the horse was walking slowly through the obstructions of Sheep Street, she discerned the young man on the pavement. She thought of that time when he had been standing under his apple tree on her return from school, and of the tender opportunity then missed through her fastidiousness. Her heart rose in her throat. She abjured all such fastidiousness now. Nor did she forget the last occasion on which he had beheld him in that town, making cider in the courtyard of the Earl of Wessex Hotel, while she was figuring as a fine lady in the balcony above. Grace directed the man to set her down there in the midst, and immediately went up to her lover. Giles had not before observed her, and his eyes now suppressedly looked his pleasure, without the embarrassment that had formerly marked him at such meetings. When a few words had been spoken, she said, archly, "I have nothing to do. Perhaps you are deeply engaged?" "I? Not a bit. My business now at the best of times is small, I am sorry to say. Well, then, I am going into the Abbey. Come along with me." The proposition had suggested itself as a quick escape from publicity, for many eyes were regarding her. He had hoped that sufficient time had elapsed for the extinction of curiosity, but it was quite otherwise. The people looked at her with tender interest as the deserted girl wife without obtrusiveness, and without vulgarity, but she was ill prepared for scrutiny in any shape. They walked about the Abbey aisles, and presently sat down. Not a soul was in the building save themselves. She regarded a stained window, with her head sideways, and tentatively asked him if he remembered the last time they were in that town alone. He remembered it perfectly, and remarked, "You were a proud miss then, and as dainty as you were high. Perhaps you are now?" Grace slowly shook her head. "Affliction has taken all that out of me," she answered, impressively. "Perhaps I am too far the other way now." As there was something lurking in this that she could not explain, she added, so quickly as not to allow him time to think of it, "Has my father written to you at all?" "Yes," said Winterbourne. She glanced ponderingly up at him. "Odd about me?" "Yes." His mouth was lined with charactery which told her that he had been bidden to take the hint as to the future which he had been bidden to give. The unexpected discovery sent a scarlet pulsation through Grace for the moment. However, it was only Giles who stood there, of whom he had no fear, and her self-possession returned. "He said I was to sound you with a view to what you will understand, if you care to," continued Winterburn, in a low voice. Having been put on this track by herself, he was not disposed to abandon it in a hurry. They had been children together, and there was between them that familiarity, as to personal affairs which only such acquaintanceship can give. "Oh no, Giles," she answered, speaking in a very practical tone, that is all very well, but I am in a very anomalous position at present, and I cannot say anything to the point about such things as those." "No?" he said, with a stray air as regarded the subject. He was looking at her with a curious consciousness of discovery. He had not been imagining that their renewed intercourse would show her to him thus. For the first time he realized an unexpectedness in her, which, after all, should not have been unexpected. She before him was not the girl Grace Melberry whom he used to know. Of course, he might easily have prefigured as much, but it had never occurred to him. She was a woman who had been married. She had moved on, and without having lost her girlish modesty, as he had lost her girlish shyness. The inevitable change, though known to him, had not been heeded, and it struck him into a momentary fixity. The truth was that he had never come into close comradeship with her since her engagement to Fitzpiers, with the brief exception of the evening encounter on Rubdown Hill, when she met him with his cider apparatus. And that interview had been of too cursory a kind for insight. Winterburn had advanced too. He could criticize her. Times had been when to criticize a single trait in Grace Melberry would have lain as far beyond his powers as to criticize a deity. This thing was sure. It was a new woman in many ways whom he had come out to see, a creature of more ideas, more dignity, and, above all, more assurance than the original Grace had been capable of. He could not at first decide whether he were pleased or displeased at this. But upon the whole the novelty attracted him. She was so sweet and sensitive that she feared his silence betokened something in his brain of the nature of an enemy to her. "What are you thinking of that makes those lines come in your forehead?" she asked. "Did not mean to offend you by speaking of the time being premature as yet." Touched by the genuine loving kindness which had lain at the foundation of these words, and much moved, Winterburn turned his face aside, as he took her by the hand. He was grieved that he had criticized her. "You are very good, dear Grace," he said, in a low voice. "You are better, much better, than you used to be." "How?" He could not very well tell her how, and said, with an evasive smile, "You are prettier," which was not what he really had meant. He then remained still holding her right hand in his own right, so that they faced in opposite ways, and as he did not let go, she ventured upon a tender remonstrance. "I think we have gone as far as we ought to go at present and far enough to satisfy my poor father that we are the same as ever. You see, Giles, my case is not settled yet, and if oh, suppose I never get free, there should be any hitch or informality." She drew a catching breath, and turned pale. The dialogue had been affectionate comedy up to this point. The gloomy atmosphere of the past, and the still gloomy horizon of the present, had been for the interval forgotten. Now the whole environment came back, the due balance of shade among the light was restored. "It is sure to be all right, I trust," she resumed, in uneasy accents. "Hat, did my father say the solicitor had told him?" "Oh, that all is sure enough. The case is so clear nothing could be clearer. But the legal part is not yet quite done and finished, as is natural." "Oh no, of course not," she said, sunk in meek thought. "But father said it was almost, did he not? Do you know anything about the new law that makes these things so easy?" "Nothing except the general fact that it enables ill-assorted husbands and wives to part in a way they could not formerly do without an act of parliament." "Have you to sign a paper, or swear anything? Is it something like that?" "Yes, I believe so." "How long has it been introduced?" "About 6 months or a year," the lawyer said, "I think." To hear these two poor Arcadian innocents talk of imperial law would have made a humane person weep who should have known what a dangerous structure they were building upon their supposed knowledge. They remained in thought, like children in the presence of the incomprehensible. Giles, she said, at last, it makes me quite weary when I think how serious my situation is, or has been. Shall we not go out from here now, as it may seem rather fast of me our being so long together, I mean if anybody were to see us? I am almost sure, she added, uncertainly, that I ought not to let you hold my hand yet, knowing that the documents, or whatever it may be, have not been signed, so that I am still as married as ever or almost. My dear father has forgotten himself. Not that I feel morally bound to anyone else, after what has taken place no woman of spirit could now do, that several months have passed. But I wish to keep the proprieties as well as I can. Yes, yes. Still, your father reminds us that life is short. I myself feel that it is. That is why I wish to understand you in this, that we have begun. At times, dear Grace, since receiving your father's letter, I am as uneasy and fearful as a child at what he said. If one of us were to die before the formal signing and sealing, that is to release you, have been done, if we should drop out of the world and never have made the most of this little, short, but real opportunity, I should think to myself as I sunk down dying, would to my God that I had spoken out my whole heart, given her one poor little kiss when I had the chance to give it. But I never did, although as he had promised to be mine someday, and now I never can. ... That's what I should think. As he had begun, by watching the words from his lips with a mournful regard, as though their passage were visible, but as he went on, Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.